Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
As a new Congress comes to town, uneasy coexistence is the catchphrase. And also, please, leave a message after the tone, the business case for better phone trees. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, with financial professionals nationwide who are trained to serve the unique financial needs of their clients at massmutual.com. And by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at chevyvolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, January the 4th. Good, as always, to have you with us. Say what you will about the results of last fall's election, and people have, but things are about to get a whole lot more interesting in Washington. When the new Congress is sworn in tomorrow, the new Republican members of the House of Representatives are going to give the GOP a majority and a whole lot of power. One of the first things they're going to do next Wednesday, as things stand now, is vote to repeal the health care law. Meanwhile, the Democrat, who lives in that big house down at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, still has some things that he wants to get done. So how might that work? Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale looked into it.
Like most presidents, Barack Obama faces an incoming legislature with a mandate to change his direction. James Thurber at American University Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies says the president has an alternative.
It's like two-dimensional chess. If he gets blocked on the Hill, he can move to the executive branch and have them move on regulations that go in the direction that he wants.
Exhibit A for this strategy is the EPA, which is using the 40-year-old Clean Air Act to crack down on greenhouse gas pollution. Republicans say they'll fight EPA's plans by cutting the agency's budget. But in the meantime, Thurber says the president holds the upper hand.
You know, there are only about 300 laws passed every 2 years, but there are 25,000 regulations passed every 2 years. That's a great deal of power that the president and the executive branch have.
And some of the president's supporters are urging him to use that power. For example, to get around congressional roadblocks on energy, Neera Tanden at the Center for American Progress says the president can create an oil import fee.
A small fee on oil imports would actually kind of level the playing field between domestic and international production and would create incentives for a reduction in the use of oil.
Tanden says when Obama had Democratic majorities, of course, he worked with Congress.
But now I think it makes also sense for him to move into the executive arena and show the American people that he's not a prime minister, but he's really CEO of the government.
But that risks antagonizing Congress, which can cut funding for regulatory agencies. Andy LePerrier at the International Strategy and Investment Group says better to follow Bill Clinton's example. He fought a new Republican majority to a standstill in 1995, but worked together to get things done the next year.
They signed the Telecom Act in 96. They signed welfare reform in 96. So the achievements came in the second year, not in the first year.
Besides, LePerrier says, businesses will also push back against government by regulation. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The government agency that really controls the American economy, that'd be the Federal Reserve, released the minutes of its December meeting today. That's not something we usually spend time on, but it's worth a nod today, if only to mention this. The central bank says it's reasonably confident that economic growth is here to stay, just not fast enough to do anything about unemployment. In a related vein, more than 1.5 million people filed for bankruptcy in 2010. That's 9% more than a year earlier, and it is a whole lot of people going under. But considering that unemployment is nearly 10% and that almost 12 million homes in this country are worth less than the mortgages owed, the real question might be why bankruptcy filings aren't higher. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
Last year, 61-year-old Minneapolis resident Daniel Dahl lost his job as a software engineer. 6 months later, his credit card debts had become overwhelming, and he filed for bankruptcy.
It was humiliating. It was like I had failed, you know. But on the other hand, I was then able to survive on unemployment.
More than 1.5 million people filed for bankruptcy last year, the fifth straight annual increase. David Skeel is a bankruptcy expert at the University of Pennsylvania Law School.
Yes, the numbers are going up, but they're not skyrocketing in the way that you might expect.
Skeel points out that more people filed for bankruptcy in 2003, 2004, and 2005, back when unemployment was half of what it is now and the housing market was booming. Sam Giordano heads the American Bankruptcy Institute. He says a new law passed in 2005 made it harder to file for bankruptcy and harder for people to write off certain debts like credit cards.
More debts are non-dischargeable. There are additional procedural hurdles before one is even eligible to file for bankruptcy.
And the kinds of debts many people have right now often can't be fixed in bankruptcy, says bankruptcy expert David Skeel.
If you have an underwater house, if you owe more than the house is worth, you can't alter that mortgage in bankruptcy.
Bankruptcy filing slowed at the end of 2010 as consumers borrowed less and focused on paying down their debts. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The phrase beating Wall Street expectations is a fairly common one when we're talking about corporate profits. It has not, though, been all that common in recent discussions of Detroit. But we got December car sales numbers today, and here you go. They beat expectations. Sales last month were the highest they've been in a year and a half. For 2010 overall, they were up 11%. Pretty good performance. The tech industry's annual extravaganza, the Consumer Electronics Show, starts later this week in Las Vegas, but pre-game publicity is well underway. Today, Netflix announced that remote controls for certain televisions are soon going to come equipped with a big red button, as in the big red Netflix logo, right? And the button will take you directly to their video streaming service. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports that that could give a whole new meaning to the nightly battle over the clicker.
One in four high-definition TVs sold last year could connect to the internet, but it can be complicated to access online content with your TV remote. Lucy Hood is with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
Part of the difficulty for consumers is there's so many buttons on your remote control, it's often hard to operate.
Panasonic, Samsung, and Sony all plan to sell TVs or Blu-ray players that come with the special clickers.
Netflix is first in to get a button on the remote control, and you can be sure that everybody else will be rushing after them to do that.
Gaming companies, internet content providers, all will be looking to grab some of that real estate. Hood says that button with the red Netflix logo may be just what the company needs to keep adding to its 16 million subscribers. And Kurt Scharf of Parks Associates says the button could also make web TVs more attractive.
So it just speaks to the enormous popularity of Netflix and online streaming. The future is coming, and it's come a lot faster than I think a lot of us thought.
He says that future may have less of a place for expensive cable and satellite TV.
You hear from more and more people that they're going to say goodbye to cable because of Netflix this year.
And from more and more TV manufacturers that they're creating sets that connect to the internet. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
An interesting item now for those who follow international currencies, specifically the tightly controlled Chinese yuan. The World Bank issued a yuan-denominated bond today. It borrowed the money and is selling the bond. Not a biggie, about $60 million American dollars worth or so, but an interesting milepost as the Chinese are pressured to open up their currency to international markets. And a correction from yesterday's broadcast before we go any farther about the amazing investment performance of palladium, up 95% last year. Palladium, a metal, is rare. It is also found in the earth, but that does not make it a rare earth metal, as I said yesterday. On Wall Street today, 2011 is treating the Dow just fine. The S&P and the NASDAQ, less so. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Representative Daryl Issa is the incoming chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, and he needs some help. Politico reported today that the California Republican has sent letters to more than 150 trade associations and companies asking them to list government regulations they think are hurting the economy, hurting specifically job growth. Darren Goode wrote the story in Politico this morning. Darren, welcome to the program.
Thank
Thank you.
I want to quote from one of these letters that Congressman Issa wrote. This one's to the National Association of Manufacturers. He says, I ask for your assistance in identifying existing and proposed regulations that have negatively impacted job growth in your members' industry. And then he goes on, additionally, suggestions on reforming identified regulations and the rulemaking process would be appreciated. That's a fairly broad appeal for input.
It is. He really cast a very wide net. He sent this to more than 150 groups, and these groups run the gamut, really. We're talking about telecommunication, healthcare providers, energy companies, car companies, manufacturers, chemical companies. I mean, he really did go out there and try to get input from about everyone that you can think of.
And I imagine they are obliging him and giving him all kinds of suggestions.
From what I understand, yes.
What kinds of things are they saying? I mean, what regulations don't they like? Give me a couple of for instances.
Well, I think a couple of big areas. One is going to be the health care bill, of course. Another are EPA regulations. There are greenhouse gas controls on major emitters like power plants, refineries. Those just went into effect, and a lot of industry groups are not happy about that. And there are going to be some other EPA regulations, too. But really, it runs the gamut.
Congressman Issa is the incoming head of the House Oversight Committee. He will eventually, I imagine, hold hearings based on this input that he gets, right?
Yes, he is. He has already said that he's going to hold a hearing on the jobs impact of regulations that has not been scheduled yet. Witnesses have not been scheduled yet. But we understand that, you know, Republicans really want to shine a spotlight. And this is really the first opportunity that they've had a chance to do that.
To be fair, House majorities, whether Republican or Democratic, do tend to go as far as they can in making the White House answer their questions.
Absolutely. So Democrats do this in the Bush White House as well. I mean, it's not that unusual, frankly. But Republicans, they have an agenda right now, especially in the House, where they want to do oversight and investigations that they feel were not done in the first 2 years of this administration under Democratic rule. I mean, you know, they're really chomping at the bit here, I think. You know, they were in the minority for the first 2 years. They sent a bunch of letters to the administration, which they said went unanswered. They wanted to hold certain hearings, but they weren't allowed to. And so this is our opportunity to really take hold of the reins and to probe regulation and other matters that they've been wanting to do now.
Darren Good, reporter for Politico, on Congressman Darrell Issa's plans for hearings and inquiries into the impact of regulations on jobs in this country. Darren, thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir.
Immigration to Israel was up last year, about 16%. In all, that works out to 19,000 Jews from abroad settling in Israel last year as new citizens. But migrant workers have been going as well for jobs in elder care and agriculture. Israel invited them in to replace Palestinians who it saw as security risks. Most of those foreign workers are in Israel legally, but they are not there without controversy, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Israel is a nation of immigrants, but this isn't quite what its founding fathers had in mind. Dozens of migrant workers from places like the Philippines, Colombia, and Nepal have come to this free legal clinic at the Tel Aviv office of Kavla Oved. Besides dispensing legal advice, it also lobbies the government on the migrants' behalf. Dan Ben-David is an economics professor at Tel Aviv University. He says unlike other developed countries, Israel doesn't actually need these people.
We're not aging. We're young. We're very young. Not only that, but we have a very large share of our prime working age population who is uneducated.
Which to him means Israelis should be doing the migrants' jobs, taking care of the elderly, picking tomatoes, building houses. There's something like 200,000 foreign workers here. A lot of them are even legal. But Israel has no real immigration policy for non-Jews. And now, more than a decade after it started importing these workers, the government's trying to figure out what to do. Gina Kayubi came to Israel almost 2 years ago. She says she cared for an elderly, bedridden woman 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
There are nights she cannot sleep. She always called me, Gina, I need water. Gina, I cannot sleep. So I really don't sleep at night, the whole night, good.
Workers like Kayubi are a bargain. about 40% cheaper than Israelis. But it's all relative.
In the Philippines, I only get not even one-fourth of my salary here.
Some critics say the system exploits the workers. Among other things, there isn't a lot of oversight to make sure employers obey labor laws.
So your salary was 3-3 plus 100 every week?
Kayubi came to Kavla Oved's legal clinic to get advice because her employer just died and the family refused to pay her. Her visa's tied to her job, so if she can't find another one, she's supposed to leave. But a lot of people don't. They just work illegally. The government wants that to stop. A new police unit tracks down undocumented migrants to deport them. But there's also talk of letting some people stay, a move some politicians say would threaten Israel's Jewish character. The problem is more economic than spiritual, though. Hannah Zohar is director of Kavla Oved.
Israeli is depend on cheap labor below the minimum wage and the law. I think Israel became addicted to it.
That addiction may be hard to break. I met Clara Avidan in a park in Tel Aviv. She was there with her Filipina caregiver. She says she only considered hiring a foreigner because no Israeli would work around the clock. In Tel Aviv, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up, we've all heard this before.
Please tell me the phone number starting with the area code. You can also enter it on your keypad.
Doesn't mean we have to like it, though. The search for a better automated experience. But first, let's do the numbers. Word that the Fed plans to keep buying bonds to boost the economy got mixed reviews today on Wall Street. Those are the Fed minutes we told you about. The Dow Industrials rose 20 points, almost 0.2%, finished at 11,691. The Nasdaq dropped 10 points, a third of 1%, closed at 2681. The S&P 500 followed suit, dipped a point, 0.1%, ended at 1270. One of the big stories on Wall Street today, chipmaker Qualcomm is reportedly close to buying rival Atheros Communications for $3.5 billion. Shares of Atheros beamed up nearly 19% on this Tuesday. Qualcomm ticked up 1.5%. Good news, and Detroit, as I mentioned, Ford, GM, and Chrysler all sold more cars last year. Shares of GM gassed up 2%. Ford coasted up 0.7%. Takes oil to run all those cars, but the price of crude today retreated from a 27-month high, so shares of ConocoPhillips dribbled down about 0.5%. Bonds barely budged. The yield on the 10-year T-note dipped to 3.33%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Yellowbook 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. It's swearing-in day on Capitol Hill as the 112th Congress convenes. The Department of Labor hosts live web chats this week with agency officials. Tomorrow's chat is with the folks at OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And award-winning actor and director Robert Duvall celebrates his 80th birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
We're back. It's Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are 4 days into 2011 right now, but the truth of it is that a lot of what's going to happen in the economy this year is going to be flavored by what happened last year. One of the big debates of 2010 was financial reform. How to do it? Who should be in charge? What should be regulated? President Obama signed the Dodd-Frank bill last July, but a lot of the specifics have yet to be ironed out. So as we try to imagine what might be in the news this year as part of our series, What Now?, commentator and Vanity Fair writer Bethany McLean has this warning about financial reform.
At the increasingly congested intersection of finance and politics, the new year is going to bring the same challenge as the old year: how to write the actual laws that will make or break the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation. Right now, the landscape is murky. We've heard incessant whining from bank CEOs and hedge fund managers that regulators and the White House just don't understand their issues. The leaders of the Nonpartisan Committee on Capital Markets Regulation, which is dedicated to improving regulation, recently complained that the rule writing so far was seriously flawed and was risking lengthy court challenges and poor rules that will damage our financial system. Yet financiers clearly do have friends. The incoming chairman of the powerful House Financial Services Committee, Spencer Baucus, just uttered words that are as conciliatory as it is possible to be. Quote, "My view is that Washington and the regulators are there to serve the banks," end quote. The one thing that's clear is that it's all bad news, because while collusion between the financial and political class isn't healthy, nor is antagonism. In the years preceding the financial crisis, we saw Baucus's worldview at work. Politicians turned a blind eye to the dangerous expansion of credit, even though they knew it was more about putting money in banks' pockets than enabling homeownership. They failed to impose any oversight on derivatives or do anything to limit the skyrocketing leverage of big financial firms, because the banks argued this would stymie American competitiveness. Forget whether this was bad for consumers. It was also, in the end, bad for banks. But poorly written rules are just as dangerous. That's because financiers fight back by finding loopholes that may be more deadly than the original sin the rules were supposed to prevent. Money moves like water, and it pours into the fissures that open up between the rules with astounding speed, which means the rules have to be tough, but they also have to be smart. That takes healthy doses of both skepticism and respect from politicians, regulators, and financiers.
Bethany McLean is the co-author of a new book on the roots of the financial crisis. It's called All the Devils Are Here. We've got interviews with Bethany and her co-author, Joe Nocera. They're on our book blog. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. When was the last time you called a company or a corporate office and the phone was actually picked up by a human being? Chances are it's been a while. Most companies use some kind of automated phone system nowadays, and most of us have been driven to distraction, getting pushed into a menu within a menu or repeating ourselves to voice recognition software. Companies say they feel our pain, kind of. They're not hiring more live bodies, of course, but they do want us to have a better automated experience, as Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Insurance company Aflac sees its brand as friendly and lighthearted, qualities embodied by its waddling mascot,
Aflac,
the Aflac duck. But that affability didn't translate to the company's automated phone line.
Policyholders, or if you are interested in becoming a policyholder, press 1.
Account managers,
press 2.
And so on. Those robotic tones greeted callers for years. Last year, Aflac began an automation overhaul. Virgil Miller is the company's vice president of client services.
When you call in, we want you to feel that I am dealing with a company that values me and is family-oriented and, of course, makes me feel secure. So we were looking for a voice that reflected those type of things.
The old voice belonged to a member of staff. The new one belongs to an actress. This recording has now rolled out in almost every state.
Hello, and thank you for calling Aflac. Please press 1 if you are an Aflac policyholder. If you're an account manager, press 2.
The first time I heard it, I just started smiling, actually, and I knew it was the one.
Miller says branding was the main reason for the friendliness upgrade. Still, he hopes the warmer tone and more natural script will persuade more of Aflac's callers to stay within the system rather than switch to an agent. Automation saves companies a lot of money. According to Forrester Research, a call handled by a person generally costs around $6. That can go as high as $30 for a really thorny issue. A call handled by an automated agent costs between 5 and 25 cents. But given how frustrating these systems can be, is voice quality even an issue for customers? Richard Feinberg teaches consumer sciences at Purdue University. He says when people dial that 1-800 number, they just want their problem taken care of. But
voice quality does play a role in the initial perceptions of whether or not a problem will be resolved.
He says if a recorded voice doesn't seem authoritative or, yes, friendly enough, the customer is more likely to hit zero. GM Voices in Atlanta, no relation to General Motors, helps companies create their phone personas. Today, producer Alex Bucklew is directing actor Jason Elkins during a recording session for a wireless carrier.
I am rolling.
Sorry, I still didn't get that. Please tell me the phone number starting with the area code. You can also enter it on your keypad.
Sound familiar? I don't have one. GM Voices CEO Marcus Graham says business from big companies is up 17%.
What's happening is these large companies are realizing that they're turning their relationships over to these automated systems, and they do warrant, you know, time and energy to make sure it's a pleasant exchange and experience.
Sometimes those attempts backfire. Nuance, a speech technology company, says a client sought its services after trying automated greetings like "What's up?" and using canned laughter. Callers were not amused. They demanded a real person. Phone manner may not even matter in a few decades. Richard Feinberg of Purdue University says today's youngest customers expect to solve problems via computer or phone app.
In 20 years, people are going to wonder why they ever picked up the phone.
And perhaps why they slammed it down. Have I answered all your questions? Goodbye.
Ashley Milne-Tite for us from New York.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at Putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Swedish furniture company IKEA. The company confirmed this morning it has stopped selling old-style incandescent light bulbs in its American outlets. Pretty much had to by 2014 anyway. That's when new federal lighting efficiency standards kick in. They call for basically nothing but compact fluorescents and LEDs. IKEA will sell those, by the way. You just have to put them together by yourself. That's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. We come fully assembled. By the way, the Dow rose 20 points today, almost 0.2%. The NASDAQ dropped 10 points, more than 0.3%. The S&P 500 followed suit, dipped a point, about 0.1%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Back here next time, Germany hangs out the help wanted sign.
We have to change that and get rid of red tape for those who are really going to help our economy. We have to make their start in Germany easier.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.